Spirit Radio Podcasts.
As we discuss so often on this program and highlight the plight of persecuted Christians in many parts of the world, it's often just us covering the story, but the plight of persecuted Christians came into sharp focus in the past week because many of the mainstream media were covering the aftermath of the acquittal of the Pakistani mother of five, Asia Bibi. While the Supreme Court of Pakistan said last week she was free to go after being cleared of blasphemy charges and indeed a death sentence, she actually, we believe, remains in detention, and groups of protesters are calling for her public execution. And it's also been reported her lawyer has fled the country and travelled to another country for fear of his life. I think there's just sadly other fresh examples around the world of how followers of Jesus are suffering for their faith. We are going to chat today to David Turner of Church in Chains about a little bit of an update, but how we can also encourage people to really pray for these people in the persecuted church around the world. And we'll be talking about that today as well. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
I think probably the best thing to do is, because there's so many layers now to this story, is kind of start chronologically. So let's start off with last Wednesday. What happened then?
Okay, last Wednesday, the Supreme Court of Pakistan, in a verdict that had been waited for years, declared Asia Bibi innocent of all the charges that had been brought against her. So it was a day of great rejoicing for Asia Bibi and her family. Her lawyer, who had bravely stood up for her over the years, he was speaking to her on the telephone in prison, and she said she just couldn't believe it, that she was full of joy.
How many years was she in prison now, David?
She was imprisoned for 9.5 years.
And what was the reason?
The reason was, it goes back to just a row in the fields where she was picking berries with Muslim co-workers. A row over a drinking vessel. She drank water from a vessel, and her Muslim co-workers said that because she was a Christian, she'd contaminated the water. And different words were used in this argument. And the Muslim co-workers criticised Christianity, and Asia Bibi said, "Jesus died on the cross for me. What did Muhammad ever do for you?" And at that, they tried to kill her. She was rescued by the police, thrown into a cell in her local village. And then a local imam said, "We'll file a formal charge of blasphemy against Asia Bibi." And that happened in June 2009, and she's been in prison ever since.
So 9 years later, the day that she has been praying for, and indeed all of her family, happened. And I remember on the day of reporting, David, of course, my first reaction was, thank God, this is great news. The next thing was, oh my goodness, what is going to happen next? Because not everybody wants her to be off death row, and fears for her safety. And what do we know about what is going to happen next to not only Asia, but also her family?
Yes, indeed. Well, this day had been well flagged in advance, and it was widely expected by those who've been looking at the case that Asia and her family would be flown out of Pakistan the very same day. And they'd be flown to somewhere in Europe, because several European countries had said they'd be happy to take...
They'd offer asylum, basically,
exactly,
to her and her family.
So this was all known in advance. Now, for some inexplicable reason, the Pakistani government did not do that. We don't know why. We don't know whether it was incompetence. We don't know whether there were elements within the Pakistani government.
Surely those, some of these countries that had offered asylum would have been liaising with the Pakistani government.
Exactly, exactly.
Well in advance. I mean, it wouldn't have been a simple operation to try and safely get her and her family on a plane and to another country and all that.
No, indeed. This could easily have been planned in advance. And, I mean, there's precedent for it. There was a young girl called Rimsha Massey who was accused of blasphemy about 7-8 years ago. And I remember the pictures of her being flown out by helicopter. But the Pakistani government didn't act in that way. They let the situation drift, and into the vacuum came protesters out onto the streets Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And the protesters' demand was very simple: hang Asia Bibi. There were chants. I saw them on videos. We don't want water. We don't want electricity. We want Asia Bibi hanged.
So really not... getting her out of Pakistan safely and her family's added fuel to an already scarily intolerant fire.
Exactly, exactly. So one looks to political leadership in situations like that. So Imran Khan, the Prime Minister of Pakistan, went on television on Wednesday night and said to the protesters, don't challenge the state on this. And then he went off to China for meetings with the Chinese government. And then by Friday evening, the Pakistani government went to the protesters and said, OK, we'll give in to your demands. Please call off the protests.
So, but their demands are?
Their demands, a very simple demand. They had two key demands. One, keep Asia Bibi in Pakistan, place her name on the exit control list so she's not allowed to leave Pakistan. And two, we want to challenge the Supreme Court decision.
And so there's a chance that she's going to be detained and she could be kept in prison?
Yeah, nobody knows exactly where she is, but the best guess of most people is that she's in exactly the same prison that she's been in for the past number of years, possibly in a different cell, possibly under heavy security. But the upshot of this is that a woman who has been declared innocent by the highest court in Pakistan is still a prisoner, and that is not justice.
After 9 years already. In terms of, I suppose, what Ireland could do, I mean, presumably, David, we could offer her asylum. Have you been in contact with government here or indeed the Pakistani embassy?
Yes, yes, indeed. And, you know, a number of people may be aware that in the context of our blasphemy referendum just a few weeks ago, Brendan Howland, the Labour Party leader in the Dáil, spoke up on behalf of Asia Bibi. His point was that Ireland didn't need a blasphemy law and that blasphemy laws are misused around the world. And he said to Leo Varadkar, you know, will you investigate the Asia Bibi case? And on that occasion, Leo Varadkar said that he would raise it with the Minister for Foreign Affairs and see if Ireland could let their views be known on that. So, in the aftermath of that, yesterday, I wrote to Simon Coveney, our Minister for Foreign Affairs, a man who, in the past, has stood up bravely for human rights. During his time in the European Parliament, he took a great interest in religious freedom and human rights. So he's familiar with the issues and sympathetic, I believe. And I just asked him I appealed to him to do two things. One was to make Ireland's view clearly known to the government of Pakistan, that what has happened is wrong, and two, to offer Asia and her family asylum in Ireland. As Brendan Howland said in the Dáil, it's not a big ask to offer asylum to a family fleeing persecution.
And I presume you haven't had a response yet?
Not as yet, no, but we will be keeping close tabs on.
And what about the Pakistani embassy here? Have they made any statement on the situation?
No, they haven't as yet. So I've had previous contact with the chargé d'affaires in the Pakistani embassy. So yesterday I telephoned the embassy to speak to him. And the response that I got, and I would have to say that obviously a diplomat has to follow the government line, and he was trying to make the point, well, the idea of a review petition of a Supreme Court decision, that's within the laws of our country and we just have to wait and we just have to let things take their course. But I suppose the main point I was making to him and the main point I'd make publicly is that the government of Pakistan has a responsibility to treat all of its citizens fairly. And it has not treated Asia Bibi fairly. It is not fair. It is not just. It is not right.
And they basically gave in to the demands of violent protesters.
Exactly.
Which, no matter what the issue is, isn't a good precedent to set.
Certainly
it's not a democratic way of running a country.
No. No, indeed. I mean, democracy has been thrown aside. The rule of law has been thrown aside. The idea of religious freedom has been thrown aside. And, you know, justice delayed, we often say, is justice denied. And justice has been delayed for Asia Bibi for 9 years. And, you know, an innocent woman is now in custody and without, at the moment, any sign of release. So really encouraging people to pray for Asia Bibi, to pray that there will be a way out. We can't see there's a way out, but Christians believe in prayer. We know from the Bible and from Christian history that often miracles take place, and we need to pray for a miracle for Asia. We need to pray that she will know God with her. We need to pray for protection for her family, wisdom for all who are seeking to help her, and for the Pakistani government.
And perhaps something that is something that we can unite together on the International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church, which is on Sunday, the 18th of November. How can people get involved with this, David?
Yeah, this is an annual day where the whole idea is that as people go to church on that particular Sunday as part of the occasion in church, that time will be set aside to pray for the persecuted church around the world. So we very simply produce some resources that focus on one particular country each year, so that whether it's just the prayer of the faithful during a Sunday Mass, whether people divide up into prayer groups to pray so that everyone has a chance to pray, whatever format of prayer is used in the church
just that
you go to,
that it's highlighted. Very simple, yeah.
Yeah. So what we've produced is we've produced a bookmark, very simple bookmark that says pray for North Korea. We selected North Korea this year because North Korea is generally thought to be the hardest place in the world to live as a Christian. And there are five prayer points on that bookmark: praying for Christians who have to practice their faith in secret, praying for Christians who are in labour camp, praying for the people of North Korea who are living in extreme poverty, praying for those who are trying to help, and praying for the leader of North Korea that he will change and govern his people with justice and compassion. So together with that, we produced an information sheet that whoever's responsible for leading prayers in the church, they'll have an idea about what way they can go about it and use these materials. If they just have a few minutes, there's a guideline for a few minutes. There's just a formal prayer that people can just pray if they don't want to use their own words. And then for churches that use PowerPoint, maybe to project their song words, we've put together a short PowerPoint presentation that would take 2 minutes to run. So all those resources are available from our website, and we'd encourage people. It's Sunday week, so about 10 or 11 days away. Get onto the website, order resources. If you tell us you want 50 bookmarks, we'll send you 50 bookmarks. If you tell us you want 300 bookmarks, we'll send you 300
Great
bookmarks.
Stuff. And it's all there for you, so easy enough to get involved. As David mentioned there, you can go onto the website for all that information, which is churchandchains.org. Earlier on the week, just looking at the cost of private health insurance, and it's a huge expense for a lot of families, especially those whose income is above the threshold to qualify for a medical card, but then they kind of fall between two stools because they also struggle to afford private health insurance. And then, of course, it makes me angry, certainly, that it's sad that in this country that we need private health insurance, or we feel we should need it. And you compare, you know, and I've had the experience myself where, because I had private health insurance, didn't have to go on a waiting list for a year and a half or 2 years. It does seem totally unfair. And also, you have to remember that we are the only Western European country not to have universal health coverage of primary care. So that's basically universal health care, where people get treated according to their need rather than their ability to pay. Now, this is something that was mooted by the government in 2011, and here we are 7 years later and still no sign. I don't know if we'll see a day when universal health insurance is introduced on mainstream. On the line today to speak to us about just the current state of health insurance, but also, I suppose, a key thing for those who want health insurance is to shop around for the best value cover. We have health insurance specialist at irishhealthinsurance.ie, Patrick Brennan. Morning, Patrick. How are you?
Morning, Wendy. Great to speak to you.
Well, what do you see as the main differences between private health insurance and public health care?
Well, I suppose if I give you the off-the-shelf answer, the reasons I suppose people would have, or the benefits that would be held by having private health insurance over not, is a greater choice of facilities, a greater choice of consultants, and crucially, and the one that really has been the driver for the percentage of coverage we have on health insurance, is speed of access to care. Unfortunately, that's probably not the way it should be. But, I mean, if you consider that health insurance was set up in around 1957, and it was designed, private health insurance was designed to cater for a small group of people because of the way their taxes collected couldn't avail of the public system. Very small percentage.
And how has that changed?
Well, very, very quickly, people have, you know, the UK probably has somewhere between 9 to 16% coverage in private health insurance, whereas here we had, at a dizzying height, about 52% of the population covered. And at its low, after that in the recession, about 47% of the population covered. So the people have decided through their own experiences and anecdotal evidence that health insurance is something they want, if they can afford it. because they do feel that the benefits are there in terms of not being left at the mercy of the public system. Now, that's not to say that the quality of the public system is poor. What we mean by the mercy of the public system is when they can get you in, when they can do it. And the real slow area there tends to be around the diagnostics piece, which is probably the most important in this.
Every week there's a new story about waiting lists. Heartbreakingly, last week it was all about children in need of scoliosis operations on a waiting list. And you do think, well, what happens for the parent whose child has health insurance? And lo and behold, they're able to get the operation very quickly. So, it is, I suppose, people looking at the state of the waiting lists from a public perspective. But the story kind of this week was just about people kind of falling between two stools, where they want the private health insurance but they just can't quite afford to pay it, but they're making too much money for a medical card.
Sure.
On average, Patrick, do you know what is the kind of average family, say two adults and two kids, paying out for private health insurance?
Oh, on average, I would suspect it would be around the region of 3,000 to 3,500 a year.
Yes, yeah, so it's a lot. It's a huge amount of money.
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, it's difficult really to, in terms of doing the averages. What we do is we look at the sort of the type of plan that is most heavily populated, and that tends to be a level two plan or a plan B style plan of old, semi-private room, private hospital. Now, there has been a myriad of plans in that space introduced in the last 10 years with varying degrees of premiums. So typically that plan would have had a premium somewhere in around the region of €1,200 per adult and maybe €300 per child. But because of the recession, I suppose, and the struggle people had to maintain cover, the insurers had went a long way in order to produce products that had a cheaper premium but effectively offered the same safeguards. So, for example, you can get plans now that cover, you know, your semi-private room and your private hospital for as little as, you know, €600.
And I think what happens, Patrick, is people are kind of bamboozled because there's so many different types of plans. There's hundreds of them, really. Mm. And I think people don't really know what they're paying for a lot of the time.
Oh, you're right. And I mean, it's something we experienced, you know, in our own office during the recession years. We definitely felt that the number of people who dropped private health insurance did so probably because they weren't aware of what alternatives were there. Whereas we felt we had a greater retention rate in our own book of business because ultimately, if the difference was having no cover and having some cover with maybe an excess of €600 should you get sick, well, €600 wasn't going to be a barrier to care in the same way no cover was. So there are options. I mean, effectively now you could have a family covered, you know, for the region of maybe €1,400-1,500 in a plan that would essentially do the same things if you're in dire straits. The only thing is it might ask you to pay a little bit more at the time you do get sick, but that will not be a barrier to care. God forbid you get a bad diagnosis, which means you need an operation.
I in terms of how it works, Patrick, I mean, I was only chatting to my own father the other day and he was saying that himself and my mum are paying €4,000 a year. And I said, wow, have you shopped around? It's such an amount of money. And he said, well, it's just because we're older. I thought it wasn't meant to work like that. I thought it was the case of, you know, younger people like myself who are relatively healthier. It's meant to kind of work that by the time you get older, you've kind of paid your dues, as it were.
Yeah, no, you're right. It is that way. There's no reason that your father should have to pay a different premium than you, except for he's on a different product than you. Now, some of those products might be old and have been around for a long, long time, such as the Plan Bs. And by virtue of that, they will tend to have an older age population. And by virtue of that, the insurers will tend to price them higher. Now, the Health Insurance Authority, however, insists that there is a significant enough difference between one product and another in order to have different premium levels. So there will have been some tinkering around those plans in order to justify a higher premium on it, say, for example, €1. And that tends to be orthopedic procedures, the idea of maybe his plan will fully cover you for a hip, knee or a shoulder replacement, whereas yours might have a shortfall in that space. But I suppose where we do the maths is we say, you know, you go in with your eyes open, you say, okay, this plan does the same as this one, bar X, Y, and Z. Now, X, Y, and Z, how likely are they? And if they happen, when will they be likely to happen? And what's the shortfall you might incur if it does happen? as against the premium saved in the years between now and then. So, you know, it is a, it, it's a consumer headache, but there is people there to hold their hand on it. The report is very interesting. It is a problem, and you know, I suppose from a, again, if we look at a macro view of this, about 30% of the population have a medical card, which is quite significant. If you are over 70, you're entitled to a medical card unless your income is quite high. I think it's 500 euros or more if you're single, and 900 euros or more per week if you're a couple. Once you're over 70, so a lot of 70-year-olds will qualify for that. So there's a large portion of the population who are on it. Then we have about 46% of the population with private health insurance. You can be very sure that there's a crossover there also. That some people, and I've met them, who will have their medical card but will also insist on keeping the private health insurance. And then, of course, there's that group in the middle who either think they can't afford it or who can't afford it. And the first thing is to find out, is for them to find out what group they're actually in. Can they afford it, or is it really out of their reach?
How important is it to shop around, Patrick?
Oh, it's crucial. I mean, it's crucial. I mean, you put it this way, you could be an expert in this industry in 2017. And if you close your eyes for too long, you're no longer an expert in 2018. And the system is designed in such a way that the change is constant across a myriad of plans. That mean if you're not constantly in this space, you're going to lag, and your advice won't be as good as it should be really for such a changing market. That presents a big problem for consumers. It presents a big problem for corporates even, who have, you know, HR and benefit specialists doing this job. Once it comes around once a year, the rules may have changed. So really the thing is to get advice. And that advice might be simply sitting yourself down on the Health Insurance Authority website and then ringing the insurers and asking them what you found out from there. Or, you know, or better still, in my opinion, you use somebody who's in this space all the time. And there are a number of health brokers out there who specialise in it.
Great stuff, Patrick. Yeah, I think it's about getting advice is really, really key, especially when it's difficult to navigate. As I say, even when you're kind of working in the industry, it's so ever-changeable and complex, so that's a good idea.
Crucially, the big issue here, and I suppose, is, you know, why is it fair? No, it's not fair that we need private health insurance. So the solution to that is not simply to dump the private health insurance market. The private health insurance market is there by virtue of the fact that those who are signed up to it feel they need it. So in other words, you can't stop people joining the quick queue until you have fixed the slow queue. So the public system has to reach a level that is efficient as the private system before you can start thinking about dismantling the private system. And this is what Sláinte Care is trying to address, starting at the primary care side. We've made some inroads into that with regards to GP cards and stuff for kids. It's a long way to go. It's very welcome. Everybody is for motherhood and apple pie, but how long will it take to implement this? And the big question is, if we look back from the foundation of the state since the 1920s, every 30 years, every generation, we've had a major recession in this country. And the two budgets that get hit most on foot of those recessions tend to be health and social welfare. And it's the health budget being hit every 30 years which has put us back in making any real progress in getting ourselves to where, say, the UK is or Germany is.
Patrick, thanks so much for your thoughts this morning and joining us on Spirit Radio. That was Patrick Brennan from Irish Health Insurance. It was front page headlines in the newspapers today. The fact that there is 180 amendments being proposed to abortion legislation, which is beginning its discussion today at the Oireachtas Health Committee stage. And it's going to be discussed over the next number of days. And on the line to talk to us about some of the proposed amendments and what she feels might happen next, I have Caroline Simons, who is legal consultant to the Pro-Life campaign. Caroline, good morning to you.
Morning, Wendy.
Okay, that's what the figure that's been put out there, 180 amendments. But I have to say, detailed in the newspapers today, it all really seemed to just focus on, I think, perspectives of those who are coming from, I guess, a more pro-repeal perspective. But I do know there is a lot of amendments. And, you know, one could argue you wouldn't even necessarily call them pro-life amendments, but kind of common sense amendments in many cases. And I would imagine many of them being put forward, those who voted for repeal of the legislation would support them and would be shocked to know that they have to be inserted in the first place. You might talk us through some of the amendments that are being proposed.
I will indeed, Wendy. And one of the things that I've seen in the newspaper reports this morning, yes, there are 180 suggested amendments, but the journalists seem to be absolutely confident and have reported that not one of them from pro-life TDs will be accepted. They're all going to be rejected.
Why not? Do you think there's just a blanket attitude in government to just ignore pro-life TDs?
Well, I think so. I mean, there's no doubt about it. This is a cosmetic exercise that's going on over the next 2 days. The bill has already passed its second stage vote in the Dáil. And the committee going through the legislation line by line debating the amendments seems pointless if a decision has already been made that there be no deviation, that there'll only be some very minor changes, all of which will be from a pro-choice perspective.
Surely that in itself flies in the face of a democracy, because I'd imagine for many of these TDs they're tabling amendments because they have analysed the legislation firstly, but also I would imagine that members of their constituency, whatever way they have voted, have been in touch with them about various concerns, and they're just trying to relay the concerns of those constituents.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's absolutely reasonable. And I think that a good number of people who did vote to repeal the Eighth Amendment will be pretty dismayed about just how far this radical legislation of Simon Harris's is going. I mean, I'm most concerned about it. There's little that can be done now other than the people listening to this programme must contact their TDs as fast and as many as they can to see if anything can be done in the discussions that are going on this week. But, I mean, Minister Harris said to the Dáil earlier this year that his legislation was going to be a prohibition on late-term abortion and that there was a specific prohibition on abortions for disability. Neither of those statements are accurate. There is no prohibition on late-term abortion in his legislation, and there is no mention whatsoever of the word disability. So on those two things, just to say to you that, you know, it is very apparent that except in the case of, except in the case of the 12-week abortion, which can be given for any reason, abortions may in fact be done without time limit, where the baby has a condition which doctors say will enable them to predict that it won't live beyond 28 days after birth, and where there's an emergency. And, you know, it may be that the TDs who are pushing this are trying to make it seem that it's very reasonable to have no time limit if there's an emergency. That would be the case if what we were talking about is simply terminating pregnancy to save a woman's life. But there is no evidence base whatever for the proposition that you need to actually intentionally end the baby's life in order to save the woman.
Usually so the kind of medical process would be where there is a medical emergency that the pregnancy would end, so that there will be early delivery essentially, which depending on the gestation of the baby might survive.
Yeah, and we've been told this so many times before. I mean, I do remember in 2013 even the current master of the National Maternity Hospital saying we do not, you know, kill babies, we deliver them. And on occasion, we have to deliver them so early that they won't survive. And that has always been the case. That has always been best practice medicine. But this is going way beyond this. I see in the newspapers, a suggestion, I don't know from which side, that the action carried out under the legislation will be amended from intentional ending of the life of a fetus and changed simply to abortion. And that I find interesting.
What legal implication does that have? Is that just a case of trying to hide what's really happening with the language, or does it actually have a knock-on
effect?
I
do think so. It seems that it's not going to be, well, I'm not sure, it seems that it's not going to be accepted, but it's interesting because it is clear now that what will be included in this scheme for abortion is foeticide. We know that in the UK, that in late-term abortions, the Royal College has advised, and the practice now is, that the baby is given an injection of a poison into its heart, of a chemical into its heart that will make it stop, and that will result in what one obstetrician in Dublin has rather euphemistically described as the baby being born asleep. Well, of course, it's not being born asleep, Wendy, as we all know. It's not being born alive, and that's the point. So that is going to be part of this package. There are obstetricians who are on a working group of the college who are looking for this at the moment.
What happens, Caroline, in a situation which I know has happened in other countries on many occasions, including the UK? What happens if the baby is born alive, i.e. the attempt on their life through abortion fails? What happens then?
Well, interestingly on that, the whole point of having foeticide is to avoid there being live births. That direction was brought in the UK after the scandal of those cases arose. And that's why the doctors working on enabling the provision of abortion services in Dublin or in Ireland, I believe, are trying to make sure that foeticide is part of the package so they can avoid live births. But inevitably, you're right, there may be some that do occur. And where that occurs, there is no provision in the legislation for what is to happen next. It is the case that where doctors consider it not necessary, just appropriate, if there's a risk to a mother's health or her life that doesn't have to be immediate, if they consider it appropriate to deliberately and intentionally end the life of the child, that's one thing. But if they simply terminate the pregnancy, it's not quite clear what is to happen after viability.
Caroline, you might talk me through...
I beg your pardon, can I just clarify that, actually? The provision of the legislation is that up to viability, you can terminate the pregnancy on the decision of a doctor that it's appropriate to do with the risk to a mother's life or health. After viability, Wendy, the legislation does not say what is to happen.
So that's unclear at the moment. In terms of just some of the amendments, and I know there are many, but what are the amendments that people you think should be particularly concerned about that are being put forward?
Well, one of the things that is of most concern, and we can all understand why, for doctors, is that doctors who look at their medical council guidelines, look at their obligation to act ethically and to act according to an evidence base, to ensure as far as they can that they look after the health and lives of mothers who are pregnant and try to preserve the lives of the babies that they carry where practicable. Those are their obligations in medicine and according to the Medical Council's guidelines. Now, this is going to change under this legislation because the duty that is being brought in is to end the life of the fetus. And so doctors who don't regard this, there's no medical evidence base for it. Doctors are obliged to practice according to best medical practice and according to an evidence base. So there will be doctors who will look and say, we don't think this is good medicine. And anyway, we don't think that the function and purpose of medicine is to end life. It's to preserve life and restore health as far as we can. So we want to exercise our right to conscientious objection. Now, interestingly, when you examine the provision of conscience protection in Minister Harris's legislation, he's reduced it to a simple interpretation clause. He hasn't given it any positive or any substantial protection at all. All he has said is who can exercise it, and he has given that even a very limited definition. So first of all, we would consider people in the pro-life side of this debate that the conscience clause has to be as wide as is necessary to cover the people who may come into contact with a pregnant woman and be giving her care of one sort or another in her pregnancy. And this has also been advised by the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission. And so we're not looking for anything that would be unusual there. We're looking for something that would be very sensible. So even looking at the UK legislation on conscience protection, they do talk about any other person, and we should also be including that kind of a description at the very least to include pharmacists who are going to have to prescribe this medicine.
Briefly, Caroline, you might just talk us through some of the other amendments that are being tabled.
I will, but just to say to you too, there is nothing in this legislation that would stop any hospital or medical authority or university from putting a condition of employment or training on a doctor which would compel them to participate in abortions. And that means that the conscience protection Minister Harris has put in his bill is pretty well meaningless. There is also no traction at all, it seems, from the reports in the newspaper today for the suggestion that where the pregnant girl is under 16 years of age, that her parents should be notified. That's being rejected out of hand, and I would question in that circumstance, you know, who really does have the girl's best interests at heart? Is it her family and her parents, or is it the state that will simply accompany her on her journey to have a termination? We remember the case of Miss C, who was brought to England in that situation and who has regretted her abortion ever since. I think it's just not acceptable that parents are being written out of the equation when their children are concerned in such, you know, it's such a life-altering decision. There has been no uptake either on respectful disposal of fetal remains, and I know there is concern, having seen what happened with Planned Parenthood institutions in the States, that fetal parts not be sold and not be given to pharmaceutical companies, etc. There's absolutely nothing in the bill about that. The suggestion that conscientious objection has to be kept very small and tight to make sure that enough doctors are available to give meaningful access to abortion to women just doesn't hold water in Ireland, because from what we have seen from both the Taoiseach's statements and Minister Harris's statements, they expect to roll out this service from next year as early as January. And it has always been the case in the international push for abortion services internationally that they either look for mandatory referral by unwilling doctors to doctors who will provide abortions, or they look for an easy, direct referral system for the woman. And in the case prescribed in Ireland, they're going to have an opt-in service, which means that women will be able to identify doctors who are willing to provide the services that they look for, and therefore it's not necessary to have anything other than a proper and robust conscientious protection for doctors who don't want to engage in this kind of work. Unfortunately, the way this legislation is pushing the practice of medicine in Ireland, it really means that unless in the future doctors are prepared to end life rather than restore health and preserve life, that they won't be going into areas like obstetrics.
Which is a sad situation, and I know that in countries like the UK they're actually having trouble recruiting obstetricians and gynaecologists, and some would say it's for that very reason. Just finally, Caroline, what happens next then over the next few days in relation to these amendments?
Well, it seems that the debate is going on. The debate begins today. 3 days apparently have been allocated to consider these 180 amendments, but one has to ask, what is the point where anything from the pro-life, if you like, perspective is being rejected before they've even started discussing the amendments, and that the amendments that will be allowed will be minor? Now, the thing is, the government does need the support of TDs from other parties to get the amendments that they want supported. And according to the newspapers, they think the government will be in position to win the votes with the support of Fianna Fáil and the independents. But that might not be the case. And I would hope to see independent TDs stand up and represent the well over 700,000 people who voted to keep the Eighth Amendment, and of the people who voted to repeal it, those who did not want to see a liberal and widely available abortion regime in Ireland. Because there's no doubt about it, this legislation is without doubt much more liberal than the legislation in the UK.
Caroline Symonds, legal consultant to the Pro-Life Campaign, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning, and we will continue giving those updates. Well, something I will never forget from my college years was losing a classmate to a cardiac death. It happened so suddenly and all of us were in shock. And I think many of us will have heard devastating stories like this, where we hear of a young person, fit and healthy, who just drops dead from sudden cardiac death. About 80 young people aged between 1 and 35 die from this condition every year in Ireland. So can anything be done to prevent it? Is there screening, for example, that can happen? Well, our next guest is the new chairman of CRI, which stands for Cardiac Risk in the Young. And he's going to share with us a little bit of his story and also just about the availability of screening checks as well. Delighted to have Tommy Feagan on the line. Good morning, Tommy. How are you?
I'm good, Wendy. Thank you very much.
Well, before we go into the work that CRI does, Tommy, you might tell us, first of all, a little bit about your own family story.
Okay, well, I live in South Armagh, just outside Newry. I had three boys and a girl, twins, Kevin and Rory. And on the 3rd of September 2010, Kevin, one of the twins, dropped dead suddenly with no warning. He was very fit, healthy. He was 24 years of age. He had just the previous year qualified as a music technology graduate from Queen's University, Belfast, and he had started lecturing in the Armagh Regional College, and he just completed his first year. He won a scholarship to go to the Milwaukee Irish Festival to do music technology experience there, and he absolutely loved that. That was in August, and he came back. And I'm big into Irish traditional music myself, and he kept saying when he came back, it was great, Dad. He says, I have to talk to you. We'll go down to the pub someday and have a crack about it. Because every time we were around the house, all the kids and grandchildren were there, and we never really got a good chat. And two or three times towards the end of August and into early September, we were threatening to have this night out. And we never had it, because he dropped dead suddenly on the 3rd of August, 3rd of September.
What happened? Was he playing sport, or?
No, Kevin, he was fit, very fit, and went to the gym and that, but he wasn't playing sport. He was simply, he just finished his dinner about 10 to 8 on a Friday night, and he just turned around and said, I'm not feeling well, and collapsed, and according to the medical reports, he died instantly. The sad thing about it was, He had a bit of a wreck of a car, and he was looking alone with my wife's car the following day. My wife and I were going out for a meal, and we were driving past his house. She was busy trying to contact him on text, so her head was down looking at her phone. I'm driving past. He was just off the main road, but I could see his house. There was two sets of semi-detached houses. And I looked over, and I saw an ambulance, and I said to my wife, oh, there's an ambulance outside the car, the house next door to Kevin's. She looked up and said, it's not next door to Kevin's, it's Kevin's. So I did a U-turn, drove into the drive, and the paramedics were working on him, and we arrived in the scene. So that's how we discovered Kevin died.
In terms of, obviously, for any parent who loses a child, Tommy, but the actual situation where it is sudden cardiac death, where it's like that, where a healthy young person just drops dead, is there any underlying risk? Is there anything that we can actually do? Is it because there's underlying heart condition there that you might know about, or did you ever find out the reason why Kevin died?
Well, the answer to the last question is no, we never found out the reason why. We got involved with CRI, and I'll tell you about that later, but we got screened, and for all deaths of sudden arrhythmic or sudden adult death syndrome, about 50% are due to an inherited genetic fault. 50% aren't. We were in the latter category. So the good news from the from our point of view, but the rest of the family, was that there was nothing genetic that would cause alarm bells about any of the rest of the family being at risk. But the bad news is we don't know why he died. His heart was in perfect condition. There was, you know, years ago they would have put that down to heart failure or a heart attack, but there was nothing physically wrong with his heart. And the most likely explanation they tell us is that there was an electrical fault between his brain and his heart. So the brain sends an electrical charge to the heart, you know, all the time, and it's like the valves in a car, they're going up and down, and when the brain for some reason doesn't send the electrical charge, the heart gets overexcited and fibrillates, hence defibrillation. And once that starts, unless you're very, very near a defibrillator or in a hospital ready to be supported, you know, the chances of surviving are very, very remote. And the ambulance was with Kevin. We live near the Daisy Hill Hospital in Newry. The ambulance was with him in minutes. But no, there was no chance. So, but we, to come to the cry bit of it, then, you know, my wife, you know, in the immediate aftermath of it, you know, she's looking for answers why, and I was in denial. I was saying it doesn't matter why he died. He's passed away. He's gone. But she came across an organisation in England called Cry UK. She contacted them, and they were very supportive, and they invited us to come over to London for screening. But then almost immediately she saw Cry Ireland, and they were in Dublin, and we're just an hour from Dublin. So they made the same offer. So obviously we took the shortest route, and the thought of getting on a plane as a family and going to London and checking into a hotel and all of that in the immediate aftermath was a bit of a horror story in itself. So we came to Cry, we got screened, and we've continued to be screened as part of the process here. But of equal importance was the fact that the medical side of what Cry did was tremendous, but the non-medical side and the family support was equally important. And we couldn't have really survived without that. And
so they offer basically counselling, do they, Tommy?
Yes, they offer counselling for people who want it. That's formal counselling, but the whole organisation, the family support service works on the basis of there are volunteers who are trained, who are available to talk to someone. So throughout Ireland, we've got volunteers in north, south, east and west. So if someone just wants to talk to somebody, they're available. If people are really struggling, and a lot of people, obviously, everybody's really struggling, but some people, you know, would benefit and want more specialised support. So we provide access to psychotherapists. We pay for that. These are professionals in the field who we contract to work with people. So some people don't require that, some do. Those who do, we make it available and as often as they want. And that's the non-medical side of Cry, which is so, so important.
And what about the screening side of things then, Tommy? For people listening, who should get screened in terms of, is there a particular risk category, or what should people be thinking about?
Well, there's different levels to this. In the first instance, the vast majority of young people are going to grow up healthy and not be affected by this. So there's no need for parents just on a whim to suddenly decide they want to be screening kids for no other reason. There's a tiered level. If there's a history of a death in the family like ours, screening would be advised. And the first port of call for any screen, any parent listening this morning, is your local GP. We only take referrals through GPs. The reason for that is we're a small organisation. Screening takes a couple of hours. It's a very intensive. We give feedback and assessment that day to people, and it's free. So we couldn't simply open the doors to everyone and anyone who's concerned. The way to filter that and to identify those who are most at risk and therefore most urgently in need of support is through the GP. And the GP knows the family history well, and he can advise various forms of looking for screening at different levels.
And is it important as well, Tommy, to have a reminder for people to be, we kind of ourselves have to be on the ball. I know, for example, my husband's mum, my mother-in-law, has had cardiomyopathy, and you know, at the time the doctors say, make sure you get screened every such and such years, and of course the years go by and you realise, jeepers, I haven't actually done that, because there's nobody picking up the phone kind of telling you reminding you. You kind of have to take responsibility for your own health.
Yeah, in situations like that, families like that should be in close dialogue with a GP, and if the GP considers it urgent, they'll contact us if it's appropriate to contact us, and we will see people within a matter of weeks. The ongoing screening, when we have a family, and like my own family, it's recommended that screening is repeated for quite a few years to ensure that there's nothing that A, has been missed, or that new technology can detect something that may not have been detected before. So we would have a long waiting list of people who are back for second and third, fourth screenings. And one of the reasons why we're delighted that the government and Tallaght Hospital is backing in behind us now is that we will be opening a new centre at Tallaght Hospital in the new year. And the HSE has agreed to fund a number of medical posts that would ensure that we can do more screening faster and more intensive. So there is good news on the screening front at large looming in the future, but in the meantime we've got to work away as best we can with the limited resources and very limited facilities that we have here in Tallaght. But as I say, Tallaght has kindly, as a lead partner with us, designated brand new facilities at the hospital, and we're hoping to raise the funds to equip that shortly and move in the new year.
Well, that is good news. And Tommy, thanks so much for coming on the programme this morning to share a little bit of your story and indeed raise awareness and tell us a little bit about the work that Cry Ireland does.
Wendy, can I briefly take a chance just to mention one or two events? We have a Pure Style fundraising event in March. It's a major event for all the ladies who are into the latest style. Highly recommended. And for those who want to be fit and healthy and raise some money, we do a Camino walk in 7th to the 14th of September next year. And we also put a large team of ladies into the ladies mini marathon in June. So anyone who wants to get behind us, there's a number of ways at least they can go on cry.ie and get more details.
Thanks so much, Tommy, for joining us on Spirit Radio this morning. Some great events there that you can get involved in. And indeed, as Tommy mentioned there, the website, that's where you can just find out more information and find out a little bit more about risk factors and if you need to be screened.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.